You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, July 26th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Hello.
Hello.
So, guys, I am still at least 2 weeks away from having my house back in order. It's been six months.
Oh, my God.
So, wait, what are you working on now? What is under
construction?
So, the cabinets are in place. We're waiting for the tops to the cabinets.
Yeah.
But I thought I was going to get my appliances installed today. But then there's just so much collateral damage that keeps cropping up. So they tried to reinstall our gas oven and it was leaking gas.
That's scary.
So now we have to get that fixed and we still don't have a working oven. And then my TiVo shit the bed.
Uh-oh.
Use TiVo?
Hold on. You still use TiVo, Steve?
TiVo's awesome. Why not?
Yeah. TiVo was awesome. Like,
but
the year
every
it came
cable
out.
Company has their own DVR now.
Yeah, but it's better.
The cable company's DVRs are generally not as slick as TiVo.
Yeah, you
know? TiVo I wouldn't know, great. But
cable DVR is convenient and probably and cheap and stuff. But for just a full service DVR, I mean, I guess I haven't used TiVo in years. I guess it's a little bit better.
Whatever, we like it.
We live in an on demand world, though. What do you? What's happening?
Yeah, but you get all that. You get all that through your TiVo anyway. Now, TiVo, it's still good to be able to just say record every episode of this show and then
have it,
you know, when you want to watch it.
Yeah, I mean, I still do that with my DVR. I don't always go to the on demand because then you can't like skip commercials. There's like weird stuff with on demand.
Oh, yeah, you can't skip commercials. It's true. Yeah.
Don't let you fast
and now,
forward through.
Yeah. You can do like one button, skip it, go all the way through commercials.
Yeah, TiVo has that. You're right. And the DVRs don't really do that.
But why would it choose this moment to break, right? I mean, yeah, it's
because you're in construction mode.
The water
I know.
Could have damaged it, Steve. It could have had too much moisture. Could have damaged it.
Yeah, dust. I don't. It wasn't near the water though. But it was. So basically, there was dust. You know, a cloud of dust in my first floor for months. And plus, there's these. You know, the moving guys. You know, are a little bit ham-fisted.
Uh-huh.
To be honest with you. So who knows? Like, there's just so many things. It's just it's just a money pit trying to fix this house.
Well, you know, the good news is. It looks amazing. You know, the floors are all done. The walls are fixed and painted. The cabinets are mostly in, and it looks – it's really amazing. Like when you see a refresh of a space that you have memorized in your head, I love it, Steve, and you're going
to
love it.
It's so fun to have a new kitchen.
I know, but we're getting so close now. Like, come on. Like, we still
– finish it.
Get the electrician in here. I need that microwave working. You know, we have nothing now.
Yeah, it's a big tease right now.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so that night – when I saw the studio with like rainforest type conditions, I thought it was over. I thought we were cooked.
Sad.
You know, now that I think about it, I want to thank our patrons for contributing and helping us fix things. You know, our last goal was at 2,000 patrons, which we passed. And we did make some wiring updates and actually fixes to things that got damaged down there. So we want to thank our patrons for helping us out with that a lot. And as a matter of fact, I mean, you know, the money that is being contributed through our Patreon has done some good improvements in the studio in other ways as well, because I did get some lights. You know, we have also a couple of things on the drawing board. Like, Steve and I know that we need a studio computer that we're working towards.
Yes, yeah, so we've been paying a lot of attention to the goals that we set for ourselves on Patreon. And now that we have a better idea of the growth that we're getting and what we need to do, we're going to be reconfiguring the goals to make them match more the timeline, I think, that we're on. So we're going to be moving up the next goal, which is going to be when we hit 3,000 patrons. At that point, we're going to have enough support that we will be able to hire Jay full-time.
Yay!
Oh, my God!
Hey!
So wait, where are we right now? How many patrons do
we have? 2,200.
2,200, so we're so close.
Yeah,
we can do
close.
This quick.
Yeah.
Hopefully, yeah. So that'll be great because, you know, then, you know, it's hard keeping the ship afloat with everybody having a full-time day job. Even just having one person who can, you know, do the heavy lifting logistically is going to be awesome.
Big difference.
Yeah, guys, help us out, man. This would be so great.
Yeah, I know we're going to get there, and I feel like it was a big decision to move it from 5,000 to 3,000. But largely it's because people have been very generous and, you know, things are going very well. You know, the plans that we put in place are happening. So if you believe in the work that we do, and you want us to keep going and you want to help us spread critical thinking as far as we can, then please become a patron.
Yeah, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide. Take a look at all of our different reward levels and the different goals that we're laying out there, including our updated goals. And the other thing you could do to support the SGU is to buy our book, which is coming out October 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
We're still working really hard to try to get that over the finish line. We just, I think I could talk about this.
Uh-huh.
They pulled the trigger on the audio version of the book. That's going to be a production in and of itself. I mean, that's going to take, they were estimating 7 full days in the studio recording it.
Yeah, for the
book.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Oh, yep. My God.
That's so, a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of talking.
Still trying to figure out how that's going to happen, but that's, you know, and that's going to, they want to happen, they want to have it happen yesterday, you know?
Now, Steve, I can do all of it with different accents.
That's true.
Oh, no, don't let Jay do that.
Jay, you could do the British version of our audiobook in a Harry Potter accent. The whole
I will
thing.
Start working on that tonight. Oh my God, that would be so much fun.
He's gonna send it to the publishers on spec. He's gonna be like, guys, I was working on this for the last week.
And I'll just every chapter will be in a different region. You know, I'll just try all sorts. No. I'll do one in Regency. Oh man, this is gonna be epic.
Don't worry, this isn't really happening, but it is fun to think about.
No, but Steve, think about it, because if I get hired by the SGU full time, I'll be doing it on your dime.
That's true.
Uh-huh.
As I said, this isn't going to happen. Yeah, we're excited about, you know, everything that's coming up. We have Dragon Con at the end of August, beginning of September. And then we applied to a panel at Comic-Con New York. We'll see if that happens. We're optimistic, but we're going to be then doing a whole bunch of events. You know, we're doing, okay, so the one I could mention is I'm going to be speaking for the Humanist Association in Norwalk. So this is on October 8th, Monday. This is the HFFC in Norwalk, Connecticut at the Silver Star Restaurant. That's 210 Connecticut Avenue. So there'll be a social from 6 to 7. I'll be talking from 7 to 8:30 or so. Then we'll be doing a book signing afterwards, because this is after our book comes out. Yeah. And everyone's going to be there with me, including Kara, because Kara's going to be on the East Coast.
So yay!
If you want to get the book signed by all five of us, this is one of your few rare opportunities. But there'll be others. You know, while Kara's over here, she's going to be here for a few days before we go to the UK to QED. And then Edinburgh, and then London. So we'll be setting up as many events as we can. We're setting up right now a talk at the Cambridge Skeptics.
Oh boy.
We'll give details for that. We're setting up a talk with the Edinburgh Skeptics. So we'll make all of these details available on our website, and we'll mention them on the show when they're all ironed out. We've locked in the October 8th one in Norwalk. But there will be more upcoming. And at some point when all this is happening, I'm supposed to record the audiobook. we'll see how that happens.
Hey, just give up sleep. You'll be fine.
If I become a full-time employee of the SGU, everything is going to get better.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to dress better. The food will be much better.
Global warming.
Yes, I will go out and I'll just blow cool air outside for hours.
Why didn't the scientists think of that before?
Exactly. This is why, you know, I am science. You know, Kara? Just think of it that way. Gosh.
Guys, I think it's already going to his head.
All right. Well, Kara, get us started with what's the word?
The word this week was recommended by Gavin Stewart.
Everybody knows what that means.
Yes.
What?
The word recommended.
Said the word this week was recommended.
Yeah. Oh, ha. Huh. I get it. That took me a second.
And Kara, my jokes will even be better.
I am so obviously tired. Was it just me?
Let's make that a goal on Patreon. This number of patrons, Jay's jokes will get better.
Okay. All right, I'll throw that in there. 3,200 patrons, Jay's jokes will get better.
3,200 patrons, Jay will go to clown college.
Oh, my God. How long is that?
3,500 and he'll graduate.
All right, so the word this week was recommended by Gavin Stewart in Hungary, and he says that we should cover stridulation.
Stridulation.
I think I might have just stridulated.
Is snapping your fingers stridulation?
Technically, I don't think it is, but if you were to read the definition, incredibly concretely, you could probably argue that snapping your fingers, doing this speaking even would be stridulating.
Uh-huh.
Well, maybe not, because stridulation is making shrill creaking noises. So I guess those things don't qualify, by rubbing together special bodily structures. So you've heard crickets stridulate.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the back legs.
You've heard grasshoppers stridulate. Exactly. I think that's one of the better examples of it. Usually it's an insect. Usually it's the legs, but there are wings that can help stridulate. There are other parts of the body. There are even some snakes stridulate. And the cool thing is that stridulation happens via, what do you think? Stridulatory organs. I love that. I want to use stridulatory organ once a day.
Organs? Yeah.
You've got to figure out how to say stridulatory organ in like your everyday speech. This would be very impressive.
Organs dedicated to stridulation.
Yep, exactly.
So flatulence wouldn't be stridulation.
No, because you do – that actually has a different purpose. I think that's like the sound is a byproduct.
That's a wind instrument, Bob.
That's exactly. But so stridulation is a specifically it's an intentional sound that is made, and it's generally for – you know, some sort of purpose. Usually we would refer to it as like a chirping sound, right? Like grasshoppers and crickets make this chirping sound. But some beetles do it. Katydids do it. There's even, like I said, there's a snake that like rolls itself into a C-shape coil and rubs together for a threat display. And then there's even a bird called a club-winged manakin that has a dedicated stridulation apparatus. So it's different than vocalization. It's body parts that actually rub together and that are that evolved to rub together to make that sound. The cool thing about stridulation is, well, there's lots of cool things about stridulation, but one cool thing about stridulation is that it comes from a Latin term that means the same thing, giving a shrill sound or creaking, but that actually comes from an earlier Greek. This is like very common. Latin words often come from earlier Greek. Stridere, which is to utter an inarticulate sound, to grate or to creak. And that's actually related to, can you guys think of a common word that would be related to?
To creak.
To creak, to utter.
Strident. Is there anything that comes
strident.
Up?
Yes. Nice, Steve. Isn't that cool? Yeah. So those have the same root, which makes sense, right? But it's something that you don't really put together, I think, because of the way that the word is pronounced. Stridulation. It's a good one.
Yeah.
I like it.
I feel like we'll figure out how to use that in our everyday discourse. Send me your examples, people.
Oh, boy.
All right, Bob. I think the big science news this week was the discovery of probable water on Mars. Tell us about it.
So cool.
Yeah, this fascinating story here. Yeah, this definitely was like, I read this, like, yeah, we definitely have to talk about this. I'll take it. So Italian researchers in the U.S. Journal of Science claim for the first time of evidence for a huge underground lake on Mars. Underground lake. That's pretty amazing. The lake itself is 12 miles or 20 kilometers wide. Very, very big. It's the largest body of water ever found on Mars. Enrico Flamini, the Mars Express mission manager, told the press conference, "Water is there. We have no more doubt." He sounds incredibly certain. Associate Professor Alan Duffy at Swinburne University in Australia said, "This is a stunning result that suggests water on Mars is not a temporary trickle like previous discoveries, but a persistent body of water that provides the conditions for life for extended periods of time."
Wait, is that our Alan Duffy? That's Alan Duffy from the Australian Skeptics.
Of course.
Who she was, yeah.
I think there's only one Alan Duffy in all of Australia.
well, one physicist named Alan Duffy.
Yes,
that's awesome.
That shrinks it down a lot. So, but that's actually a good point, because we've accepted on Mars for years, right? There's water on Mars. You know, there's always been some kind of short-lived water phenomena, like in the atmosphere or sequestered away in places like the polar caps, blue skies on Mars.
Well, but we always thought it was ancient, right? Like we would see evidence that it used to be
remnants.
There.
That's a separate issue. Yeah.
Then again, even recently, I think in the past year, they saw evidence of water flowing that had flown down craters seasonally, recently.
Oh, I see. Right? I see.
But it was a very small amount, so it was kind of ephemeral and but nothing like this. Nothing like this. It's 20 miles, persistent water. Not sure how deep it is, but it's incredibly, incredibly wide. But of course, there's a downside. This is not very nice water. It's like 1.5 kilometers under the ground. So you have to dig pretty damn deep.
That's a long straw
to get to this.
So it's deep. That's really deep.
It's deep. And it's also cold and briny as hell. It's actually below the freezing point. I mean, and that, but that's
for fresh water.
What?
Yeah, that doesn't break the laws of physics. Well, not really. It's because it contains dissolved Mars salt and minerals.
Sure.
Like magnesium, calcium, and sodium. So that's the theory of why the water can get so damn cold is because of those dissolved salts.
But isn't that good for life?
No, not when it's that damn briny. I mean, damn.
Oh, it's really? Like, it's like too salty?
Right, it's too salty. It's actually, they think that it might be so salty that it probably would be fatal for any microbial life. Similar,
even extremophiles?
To what's on the earth. My take here on this is that this is like crazy salty. Really. I mean, because it doesn't make any sense for the water to be in a liquid state down there. Because first off, you don't have a lot of ice pressing down on the liquid to lower, you increase the pressure, it's going to lower the melting point. And there's no geothermal activity going on to heat it up. That's what happens on the Earth. On Mars, that's not going to happen. So how is this stuff liquid? And they think it's got to be super salty in order for it to be liquid. So that's the primary hope, right? We're talking about life. Everyone's thinking about life on Mars now, and that's the primary hope. I mean, this water could be very helpful for human consumption when we have colonists on Mars, for agriculture. It's going to be great.
Yeah, like pickle juice for water.
The thing is, both ice caps are water ice, so we already know that there's a ton of ice on Mars. Right, so this it really doesn't if you're talking about just a human colony, there's ice. There's already water ice there. It doesn't matter. So the fact that there's some deep briny water isn't probably not helpful.
It might be easier to melt ice at the surface.
Yeah.
No, but it also depends. The other fact here that you're missing is that this is not the southern pole of Mars is not a special place. They think that there could be similar underground water, subsurface water, all over Mars, and that will make a difference. If you're on the equator,
you
don't want to go to the pole, so this could be big for a lot of that stuff.
Oh, so we could have, like, Martian wells.
Right.
Yeah, maybe there's something only 100 meters below the surface.
I think I wanted to mention the instrumentation that discovered this. It was really an interesting story. This is a special radar instrument on the Mars Express orbiter. It's called MARSIS. This is Mars Advanced Radar for Subsurface and Ionosphere Sounding. MARSIS. So what they did was they did a lot of orbital passes of this, and they had to do some tweaking. But after 29 orbits over 6 years, they finally had the data that they needed. And what I really liked, like all competent scientists, they worked hard to rule out other explanations for what the radar was telling them. It could have been like deep layers of carbon dioxide ice or these other things. And of course they took that seriously and tried to say, all right, how can we prove that it's not that? And they kind of did. But even though there's all that, there still is some skepticism with this. So don't get your hopes up too much. Some of this doesn't kind of make a lot of sense. Jeffrey Plaut, who's on the MARSIS team, said, I would say the interpretation is plausible, but it's not quite a slam dunk yet. So that's what he's saying. Another guy here, we got a geophysicist, Dave Stillman. And one of the bigger problems, though, is the fact that they've used higher frequency radar instruments on board the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and that instrument cannot detect underground water, which is kind of bizarre. Geophysicist David Stillman said, it's strange that SHIRAD is the instrument, cannot confirm this discovery. In fact, SHIRAD cannot penetrate through the ice here, and no one understands why it can't. This suggests that something strange is going on here. Thus, I'm skeptical about this discovery. So on the one hand, we've got some very interesting and thorough results that say there is solid evidence, but other evidence is saying that something weird's going on here. It needs a little bit more work to be a slam dunk. So we'll have to wait for probably other spacecraft and other instrumentation to confirm this theory, but it is promising, but we'll have to see in the future. I'm not sure how far it may be. Could be a couple years or more before this is indeed a slam dunk.
I mean, I think we need to just send missions to Mars whose purpose is to drill down to this possible water to see what it is and obviously look for life. if it is there.
Well, I don't know. That might be premature. I mean, drilling down a kilometer and a half, not easy, especially for a system that you're sending so far away from the Earth with no humans around. I would think, let's definitively.
But it might not be that
let's
low.
Definitively nail this before we do something
Europa,
like that.
Europa's has 19 to 25 kilometers thick ice.
Yikes.
That's going to be a
lot harder. But they're not
going
to drill.
That's why
they're
I wouldn't go
drill.
There either. I'd go to Enceladus where the damn stuff is erupting onto the surface or in space.
It's erupting from Europa, too. There are plumes on Europa. That's the plan. Like, they can't drill. They're never going to get approval for that.
You can't get a permit.
Yeah, definitely.
No, from NASA.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Drill, baby, drill.
Yeah, I definitely
heard that somewhere.
Go to the eruptions first. I mean, imagine a probe
exactly.
in space. Flying by and grabbing some evidence,
holding a bucket out there and capturing it. Oh, it'd be so cool!
Look, microbes.
So here's something interesting I didn't know about Mars that I learned when I was doing background research for this piece, is that both the north and southern ice caps are mostly water ice, but the southern ice cap has a permanent layer of carbon dioxide ice, while the northern ice cap has only a seasonal cover of carbon dioxide ice.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so in the northern hemisphere summer on Mars, all of the carbon dioxide ice sublimates and you're left with just water ice. Whereas in the southern hemisphere, the carbon dioxide layer is thicker. It's like 8 feet thick or something, and it's permanent.
Yeah, but even geographically, there's some very interesting differences between the northern and southern hemisphere.
Yeah, the northern and southern hemispheres of Mars are very different, if you recall. Their geology is very, very different.
Yeah.
And the magnetic field, weak though it is mostly the southern hemisphere, I believe.
They're regional, yeah. It's not.
It's
like
pathetic.
Planet-wide.
It's like weak. It's beyond weak and spotty.
They call it marsulation when you walk on the surface of Mars.
That's good. I like that.
Marsulation. All right, guys, you are all familiar with the Drake equation, right?
Oh,
yes.
Sure.
Yes.
I love the Drake equation.
I love Drake's cakes. Drake's cakes.
Can
awesome.
Can anyone recite the Drake equation from
memory? Oh, gosh.
Absolutely not. No.
No.
It's like 12 components to it.
It's not that many. So the Drake equation is just a way of calculating the probability or the density of galactic civilizations out there who might be willing to communicate with us, right?
Yeah. Yes.
It is the average rate of star formation in our galaxy times the fraction of those stars that have planets times the average number of planets that could potentially support life per star that has planets times the fraction of planets that could support life that actually develop it at some point, the fraction of planets with life that they go on to develop intelligent life, the fraction of civilizations that develop a technology that release detectable signals of their existence into space, and the times the length of time for which such civilizations release detectable signals into space. Of course, we don't know any of those numbers, and the uncertainty increases exponentially with each unknown or with each uncertain variable.
And you also have to factor in some technologies may have destroyed themselves in the process.
Well, that's the length of time, Evan. That's taken into consideration. So
what's the deal? Are they revamping it?
No, but a study from Oxford researchers did some more analysis, and they were essentially correcting the math of the equation, meaning that they're essentially doing a statistical analysis and showing that not only is the uncertainty a lot greater than most people assume, but that the way the math works out, the probability of there being no life outside Earth is actually a lot greater than you think. So they didn't prove that we're alone in the universe, even though that was some of the headlines. It was more that even if you think that there's a 50-50 chance of having one civilization per galaxy or whatever, that still results in a pretty high chance of us being alone in the universe, just because of the way the statistics works out.
What?
That's bullshit. So, yeah, they're saying that the uncertainty includes that possibility. So if you could run the numbers so that the number of civilizations in the universe is one, that's us, or that there are trillions, right? Depending on what numbers you plug in.
Yep.
And and their point is, it's probably towards the lower end. And if you do the probability curve, there's a significant chance that it's one, right? That we're alone. That was their point. So.
Wow, that's a bummer.
Don't worry. Don't worry, Kara. That's baloney. What do you mean?
Baloney.
So, and they say this could be the solution to the Fermi paradox, right? So Fermi, said if there are aliens out there, where are they? Even if it takes 100 million years to populate the galaxy. You know, why hasn't that happened already? You know, our galaxy is 13 billion years old. So where are they all? That requires an answer. We have to figure out, you know, if the answer to the Drake equation is somewhere in the middle of the range of possibilities, then Fermi's paradox is paradoxical, right? It's a real question. Why haven't we detected any aliens so far? Not that there aren't plausible answers, but we have to, you know, speculate what they might be. Whereas if the Oxford guys are right, it's like, there's probably no one out there, and that's why there's the Fermi paradox is what it is.
That's so sad. I know. Like, I want to have a funeral for all the other civilizations that never existed.
Doesn't mean we have to stop looking, though.
No, of course not. This is all theoretical, and looking is empirical, and that's what we need. We need absolutely we need to look.
But you're also saying, though, in a way, it's like, you know, we're safer because a lot of people have said that it's a threat. You know, alien species are definitely a threat.
That's a negative.
That is definitely not an existential threat I think about often.
It certainly would be safer if there were no other aliens out there that could be competitive or hostile to us. I think the answer to the Fermi paradox is because space is big.
But isn't that in the Drake equation?
No, but I mean that it's really hard to get from one, you know, stellar system to another. No matter how advanced your technology gets, it never gets easy. And even if it's theoretically possible, it's a massive resource commitment. And why would any civilization make it? There just may be no compelling reason to expend the massive resources necessary to spread out too far beyond your local group of stars.
Yeah, but don't forget there's also the idea of the Von Neumann machines that can go out and harvest other planetary bodies and other solar systems and use those resources, and that even over the course of a couple hundred million years they could pretty much swamp an entire galaxy. So how come we're not seeing them?
Because nobody did it. Why would they do that?
Right. Just because you can. I mean, just the idea that you could
we do stuff all the time just because we can.
Smart.
But there are reasons not to do that.
It's not a gargantuan investment. But Steve, I don't disagree with that. My angle, my input on this is that I think a lot of civilizations turn inward and they just all live these digital lives and they may send out some probes and then the probes come back with information however many years, you know, generations later, and then you could update your database of information about what the universe is like. But I think a lot of societies are living in their just home-built worlds and universes and living that way.
And I also think that the psychology of an alien species is likely unfathomable to us.
Right, I agree with that too.
Oh, absolutely.
So we're thinking about these things from such an anthropomorphic point of view. No,
that's
anthropogenic.
All we can do,
gosh, anthropocentric. Jesus.
I know. Gosh.
Suffixes.
Come on.
But yes, jeez. We're thinking of this from such a human perspective that it's almost, It's the unknown unknowns. It's just very difficult.
But we cannot rule out the possibility that evolving intelligence is rare and evolving technology is more rare and surviving a long time may be really rare. We cannot rule that out. We human civilization may be really precious. It might be incredibly rare in the universe.
Well, it is precious.
I mean, regardless it's precious.
Yeah. I know, but even more so if you think that we're it, like we're the universe's expression of consciousness.
Oh my gosh, we are it?
Ugh. Well, Sagan did say we are a way for the cosmos to know itself.
We're the only way for the cosmos to know itself.
No, but he said we are the way because for all intents and purposes, as far as we know, we are
the
way.
Yeah, he did say someone's got to be first. Maybe it's us. Mm-hmm. You never know. But there was also another study on the flip side, astronomers said, you know, that moons of gas giants may be a more likely place to look for alien life than planets. What we need to do is go in search of these moons, right, Evan?
We do. In search of these moons, in search of...
We should go in search of alien life.
Alien life, in search of alien signals, in search of, in fact.
Yes.
Guys, there's a theme this week.
We
don't usually have like a whole themed show.
Well, it's not our fault all this news happened all at the same time. In Search Of. Do you guys remember the show In Search Of?
Yeah, of course.
I don't. I'm sorry.
70s and the early 80s before Kara was born.
I was born in the early 80s.
Leonard Nimoy, the original Spock himself, hosted the popular weekly television show, and it was popular. I even remember watching it as a kid, and I know that you guys were as well, not Kara. We were rather impressed at the time, if I recall.
We loved it.
But despite the show's coy attempts at offering possible alternative explanations to seemingly strange events and phenomena, In Search Of was, in fact, when it came down to it, pseudoscientific, anti-scientific, and lacked critical thinking and logic that the sci-fi character Spock was supposed to represent, right? Or at least the Vulcan half of him.
I mean, it was horrible. I mean, I've gone back and watched episodes, you know, in the last 10 years or whatever, and I was shocked at how terrible it was. It was complete hand-waving speculation. It's like, here's a picture of a guy. Could this be the ancient astronauts? But I mean, just like, where is that coming from? There was no connection, no logic, no evidence. It was just rampant speculation that he pulled out of his ass. It was shocking how horrible it was.
Yeah. Yep. But popular nonetheless, yeah, despite incredible. That. Yeah. Yeah. And definitely a contradiction to the character that we all, you know, loved that he played on Star Trek, certainly. So here we are in 2018, and once again, Spock is lying to us.
Yeah.
This time, it's the actor Zachary Quinto, best known for his portrayal of Spock on this decade's relaunch of the Star Trek movie series. He is now hosting the latest reboot of the show In Search Of, which can be seen quite appropriately on the History Channel. And thank goodness it's not on the Science Channel. The first episode of which debuted just a few nights ago, July 20th. In the pilot episode, Zachary went in search of aliens, space aliens, extraterrestrials, intelligent life beyond Earth. So he set out to discover whether aliens exist and what evidence we have to prove it. He met with several people who say they have encountered extraterrestrial life, including a man who has been claims to be abducted by aliens several times since childhood, and another man who claims to have extracted an alien implant. Oh, and there's a woman who shows Zach what it feels like to be abducted into a spacecraft. Yep. However, at the same time, in the one-hour show, Zach also meets with the world's leading scientists at SETI in Green Banks, West Virginia. And there, they use the world's largest telescope and show them the methods that they use to try to detect signals coming from the deep reaches of space. A mixed bag of legitimate science with paranormal and pseudoscience mixed in.
Yeah.
It's sharp. Looking, it's clean, it's modern, has all the production quality you would expect of a good Science Channel show. And I think Zachary delivers the role of legitimately curious host because he makes it sort of his personal adventure instead of just a narration. So that's kind of good in that he's active in the interviews and the scenarios. And that's different from what Leonard Nimoy had done, in which he was really just sort of narrating in the show back in the 70s. So this version is more personable. Unfortunately, though, because these things are actually kind of good, that's actually bad when you realize that this type of approach helps lend some legitimacy to that which is purely pseudoscientific. It gives equivalency and then some, where actually distinction, I think, is sorely needed. And that moves us into sort of the bad things that came out of the show, and there was plenty of it. So the bad, even when the conclusions reached ultimately turned out to be nothing burgers, such as the alien abduction and pulling implants out of people, it's the buildup, the anticipation. They use these, you know, dramatic edits and the background music and the professional actors' expressions. You know, it rings hollow. It's that formulaic, typical buildup when nothing actually happens in the final say. It's like those ghost hunting shows. Almost all of them have that feel to it. You know, the build up, and, well, nothing.
Yeah, nothing
maybe,
happens.
But maybe next time.
What was that noise?
And right off the bat, in case number one, this is the first one they start off with, and they totally fumble this ball. This guy claims to be have been abducted by aliens and also experienced many alien sightings. And in order to test the legitimacy of his claims of alien abduction, guess what they hook him up to?
What? A lie?
A polygraph. Yes, of course.
I was going to say an e-meter, so that's better than that.
It's true. Now, they cleverly have Zachary narrate a single line in there about how polygraphs are not purely scientific, right? They kind of throw that in as the disclaimer, in a sense. But then they go ahead and they take the test and they treat it as if the results are scientific.
Yeah.
So the machine says, or rather the interpreter of what the machine says, has deemed that the abductee fails his test, is not being truthful about it. But what are we supposed to deduce by this? It's crazy. It's an ugly, messy failure. And that's just the first freaking 12 minutes of the show.
The tragedy is, I think that this is a real opportunity and they could have done a show like that. And I think it probably would have been more popular, in my opinion. I think that the public is thirsting for some real analysis, evidence. You know, let's show what it really shows, right? What's the real evidence? What can we really say about this? And not the fluff. I think people are getting a little tired and sort of savvy to the fluff like this. Because as you say, it is formulaic. I mean, we've done the reality TV show, you know, ghost hunting shows or Bigfoot hunting shows to death where nothing actually ever happens. You know, as you say, the big nothing burgers. Come on, how about showing some real science? And you can definitely, you can do it on these topics, but just do it with some real hardcore analysis. But they always end up going with the fluff. You know, every time like skeptics try to do shows like this, it never gets to all the way, you know, to the end because they think that
like the audience isn't savvy enough.
Producers are risk averse. Yeah. They think that, oh, you got to give like the cheap thrill and that's the only thing that's going to sell.
That's right.
Can't get too sciencey, but they continue to believe this despite the fact that, you know, the runaway hit shows are all intelligent, scientific, high quality.
Yeah. Don't even blame the producers. Because there are people pitching good shows all the time. They're always getting shot down by the networks. It's the network executives.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's
what I mean.
Yeah. There's this real thing, you know, this real concern that we want to give people what they want and the market research shows us that they want this. And it's like, well, they're only watching that because that's the only choice you give them. Mm-hmm. And also, maybe there is sort of an ethic that everybody's ignoring. Like maybe it should be the ethical decision to provide quality, entertaining, beautiful, high production value programming that also happens to be legitimate.
Yeah. Right.
And you know?
And they do it. They can find it.
Of course they can. It's all out there. We pitch them constantly and then they say, yeah, but what if we do it where there's aliens? And you're like, wait, what? Like I told you about that time when I pitched my dinosaur show and I was working with this production company and they preemptively were like, well, when we take this to network whose name I'm redacting, they're going to say, but what about if we do an episode that's like, are there still dinosaurs living in the Amazon?
Yeah.
And I was like, we just spent months on this like science heavy paleontology show. And that's what we're going to do.
It's so frustrating. Where they go. The other thing is, I don't buy we're just giving people what they want. The fact is, people actually don't know what they want until they see it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's true.
It's a paradox of choice. Too.
Yeah, all the breakaway shows, nobody would have said that's what they wanted. You know, but it became really popular because once people saw it, they go, wow, this is great. But what this also shows, the final comment before we move on, is that, you know, this is all classic skeptical topics that they're going to be dealing with. Atlantis, UFOs, Bigfoot, right?
Loch Ness Monster. On television, by the way.
Our job is not done. We're going to have to revisit all of these topics, you know?
Nope. They are unsinkable rubber duckies. They pop back up.
Yeah, they fade away for a generation, then they come on back. And we just got to be ready to knock them down when they do.
But it's so frustrating because they're not providing any new evidence. So all we have to do is just like go back through the files and be like, how did we debunk that the last 30 times? Right. And that's the frustrating part.
Okay, Jay, I understand that scientists have discovered that people can suck energy from other people, except that they haven't. This is complete nonsense. Tell us what's going on.
Let's just start off with a baseline so we're on the same page.
You like that, Evan?
I love it.
He can't catch his breath. I love it.
The typical way that plants get energy is through a process called photosynthesis. And this is a process where green plants use light, you know, the sunlight to synthesize their food from carbon dioxide and water, right? So oxygen, of course, is the byproduct. That's, you know, and there's a lot of ins and outs, you know, there's some, but I'm just generalizing. Researchers at Bielefeld University in Germany from Professor Dr. Olaf Kruse's team back in November, discovered that plants have an alternate way of getting food. Certain plants. It's actually the green algae Shamalama ding dong. This is Chlamydomonas.
Oh, God.
Chlamydomonas.
Chlamydomonas.
Chlamydomonas reinhardti.
Just call it clammy. Just call it clammy.
Okay, so this green algae, specific one.
Yes.
It's a specific algae. It's single-celled, and along with using photosynthesis, it can actually draw food from other plants. And this was made public in a journal called Nature Communications. In this particular plant, or in this algae, when photosynthesis is not supplying enough food, the algae secretes an enzyme that can digest cellulose, which would break it down into these smaller sugar components. And then they would it would move that, whatever was left over, it would move it into the cell, and it would turn it into energy. And, you know, that's like eating. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not like eating. It is eating. Yeah, it eats the,
it's eating.
Yeah, it digests the cellulose in another plant and uses that for raw material and energy. Absolutely.
It might be novel, but it's not crazy.
It's also not novel. Maybe this particular enzyme is. Maybe that's, and I think that's the discovery. This particular algae makes this particular enzyme. But this is just a hemiparasite. That's it. There are plants that are parasites. There are plants that are obligate parasites. They get all their energy from other plants. That is not new. So that's like science reporting error number one. This is not new.
But check this out. So this actual news item was transformed into the following headline. Now, Kara, are you sitting?
Yes, I am.
Are you feeling okay? Because this one, what I'm about to tell you is going to knock you out. I love this.
Ooh. Oh, careful.
Knock me out.
This is what the pseudoscientists do with this is I wouldn't say this is a mundane news item, but you know, there's something.
Yes, it's a mundane news item.
It's mundane, it's interesting. it was fun to read about, but they take this and they turn it into here's the headline. Yeah. Scientists confirm that people are capable of absorbing energy from others.
What?
Yep. The author of the article that wrote the headline, who is only named Jasmine, right out of the gates.
Her byline is just Jasmine.
Jasmine. Yeah. Jasmine.
Wow.
Yeah. She says.
Wait, where was this published?
Runwonder.com.
Yeah, runwonder.com.
Yeah, it's a swanky website that you, but you know, you'd find this link on Facebook. You know,
that's the thing. Yeah, it makes the rounds though, right? It doesn't matter how crappily sourced it is, it's making the rounds.
Sucks.
That's true.
Well, good old Jasmine.
Yeah.
Sentence number two, they say that this discovery, and I quote, could also have a major impact on the future of bioenergy, eventually providing the evidence to show that people draw energy from others in much the same way.
Parasitic plants.
Yeah, actually, the way that they think that people draw energy from other people has nothing to do with this. It is nothing like the process.
Jay,
that
we don't secrete enzymes and digest other people?
No,
maybe you
don't. That's what I was going to say. I mean, technically, we probably could draw energy from
other
people.
Sure, we could. Yeah,
if we were hungry.
Everyone boils down eventually.
So this article is riddled with the typical over-the-top imagery that we see online. You guys know what I'm talking about. One image has like lightning bolts passing between two disembodied heads where there's like a ghost image of the brains.
The brains.
So here's a quote from Dr. Olivia Batter-Lee regarding the research. Mm-hmm. Again, prepare yourself. Flowers need water and light to grow, and people are no different. Our physical bodies are like sponges, soaking up the environment. This is exactly why there are certain people who feel uncomfortable in specific group settings where there is a mix of energy and emotions. You could also say that those people might have, you know, social anxiety.
Yeah, you might just say that that has to do with their psychology.
Yeah.
Did she call me a sponge?
So when energy...
Evan, I can't deal with your negative energy right now.
More quotes. This is fun. I loved reading this BS article. It was so entertaining. When energy studies become more advanced in the coming years, we will eventually see this translated to human beings as well, stated Batter-Lee. Uh-huh. The human organism is very much like a plant. It draws needed energy to feed emotional states, and this can essentially energize cells or cause increases in cortisol and catabolize cells depending on the emotional trigger.
That's just a mishmash. That's incoherent. So, this is the formula,
Deepak Chopra-esque.
It is. So this is very typical for pseudoscientists, where they're always trying to prematurely declare victory, right? Yeah. So they're trying to just take this short path or this like one knockout punch that proves that they're right. But they settle on anything that they can somehow twist into, you know, proving that they're right. So this is an example of is inappropriately extrapolating from something very specific to a broad general claim. And then you go from that broad general claim back down to a different specific claim. But it's passing through this stage where there's no detail, there's no specificity, there's no logical coherence. So in this specific case, they say, so an algae can secrete an enzyme in order to digest the cellulose in the plant to use as an alternate food source. Therefore, this is evidence that one organism can feed off the energy of another organism, right? They sort of translate it into vague terms. Energy, right? This is like humans feeding off the energy of their environment or other humans, but they just change the way they're using the word energy, right?
But look at the bridge that they build, like Steve's describing, like they're bridging this thing that happened in science with an idea that's completely nonsense.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about what they're saying, what these people believe. They are saying that the human mind or the human body can sense and receive energy from other creatures. So we would have to have
light, sound, you know, absolutely.
But we would have to have transmission organs and receiving
our voice,
organs.
Our ears, our eyes,
receptors. Yeah.
Right, but Steve, I'm saying what they're saying.
I understand
reality.
But the thing is, the point is, they translate it in just vague hand waving uses of terms like energy that don't mean anything specific, and then they get it confused. Right. So then they use like specific applications of energy. Like, yeah, we actually do get energy from our environment. You know, I can send signals to you that you would understand. It's called talking, you know, but then they, because they're using very non-specific terms incorrectly, you know, like energy, then they think that they could therefore extrapolate from that to anything that they want, right? Therefore, chakras are real, and you know,
yeah, oh, it's so frustrating.
Deepak Chopra does this with quantum. This is, we talked about quantum recently and many times on the show. It's the same exact thing where they say these quantum particles are entangled, therefore everything is entangled, and therefore ESP is real. But they alter the definition of what it means to be entangled in that transition by just inappropriately generalizing it as if it's a general rule of the universe from this one specific special case, you know?
Yeah.
It's also such a lazy and like, I don't know, I get
totally
so annoyed
lazy.
Because I'm super interested in, I meditate a lot and I do a lot of yoga, and like there's a lot of woo in those areas, but there doesn't have to be,
right?
Because these things can be kept really separate. Like I feel like good yoga instructors will talk about bringing, you know, feeling the warmth in your feet or bringing things up to certain parts of your body, like focusing on certain, and they're all visualization techniques.
Mm-hmm.
It's not meant to be some sort of like scientifically rigorous explanation for what's actually happening
heat
in your
energy
foot physiology.
Transfer, right.
Exactly. Like it's a way to like calm down and a way to like, what do they call it? Body scan, like the relaxing thing where you go part by part of your body in order to like relax and fall asleep. It works, but they're not actually talking about the real like chakra energy coming out of your knee.
That's
what drives me. Like,
I don't care if people meditate or do yoga or do whatever that you do to feel good or to relax or to exercise well or stretch. Fine, it's all good. Yeah, but it's when they then generalize to this, you know, metaphysical description of reality from that. That's when that's, you know, it's gratuitous. It's unnecessary.
It's insanity.
And it's silly.
It's
and it abuses
insanity.
Science. Yeah, it abuses science. Like the author of this article has no idea how science or logic works. You know?
Nope. You know, my frustration is, you know, these people are trying to use – they're bastardizing science and all the hard work that people do. And they're just, you know, plucking colors out of it and saying, you know, look at this, lights up what we believe over here. You know, obviously it's not doing that. I would just love, you know, that's why talking to Britt Hermes was such a pleasure, because she really gave us an idea of what it was like on the other side.
She's the best.
Yeah. And seeing her like come full circle is the dream. It's what we live to do as skeptics. We want people to wake up, you know, people are sadly just lost.
Well, the other thing here is that while this is an extreme example that it's kind of fun to poke holes in, but the general principle applies across the spectrum. And the lesson here is that you have to carefully define your terms. And when you loosely define terms and then substitute your loose definition for a scientific treatment, that's when you get into trouble. And of course, there are very subtle manifestations of this. And that's why people who like actually are experts in a field, they get down into the jargon, you know, because like you can't just talk about depression as if it's this one thing, for just to pick a random example. Like there's different.
And you can't talk about energy that way.
Yeah, you can't talk about energy as if it's this one thing or you know what I mean? So
like, there's nothing wrong with walking into a room and being like, ooh, there's some negative energy in here.
Yeah, it's a
like,
metaphor.
That's a description. It's a metaphor. Yeah, right. But like actually thinking that there's a – exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
What scientific instrument are you going to use to measure the energy of the room?
You'll use a scale. Use a scale, right, Evan? Like in that last study we talked about a few weeks ago. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week I played this noisy.
Whatever it is, I really want to help it.
No, that does have a pathetic sound to it,
it's
doesn't
so sad.
It? This is a hard one. I admit it. Nobody got it right. But I love those sounds that could be interpreted many different ways. So we got a guess from Janet Harvey, and she said, I have been listening to the SGU for a couple, 3 years, and she's only gotten one or you know, handful of these Who's That Noisies right. She thinks this noisy are slot cars racing.
Ooh.
No.
So my brothers and I used to race them all the time when I was growing up, and my son had a track in his preteen years as well.
Yeah.
Sure. A little bit
I
there.
I don't know what those sound – what's a slot car?
You got to look it up. Yeah, you got to look it up.
I know what a box car is.
It's a toy with a plastic track, and they race around the track with a metal contact in the center of the car. That's how
you control with the trigger. You control how much juice the car engine gets.
I know what those are.
Motor.
Yeah. I've seen those. Those are cute.
Phew. Oh,
and they can like they make you can like they have loops sometimes, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I got another guess here from a 15-year-old listener named Ramable.
15.
I think the noise is a swarm of drones because you can hear some individual changes in pitch that stand out from the main stream of noise. It's a good guess. It's not correct, but you are correct. It is several noises happening at the same time.
Oh, okay.
This is a weird one. So Dave Weldon sent me an actual sound that he recorded in his backyard. It's a drip irrigator. Do you guys know what this is?
Yeah. It's a drip irrigator.
Right.
Exactly.
So every 18 inches, there's little water dripper embed, like these little holes that are in the drip line, and these dribbles of water come out. So you turn on the water, and it's like a hose with a lot of holes in it, like tiny little holes that lets water
dribble out.
Yes.
Yeah, it's good for, and it's also good for like reducing water usage. It's better than a sprinkler because those holes are usually made exactly where the roots of the plant are.
So it was a really fun, unexpected noise coming out of something that's relatively mundane. So nobody won. Dave, thank you very much. We haven't done a noisy in quite a while because we were at Nexus and had a whole bunch of stuff going on. I have a new noisy this week.
New noisy.
This noisy, Steve, are you paying attention?
Jay, what's your noisy this week?
This noisy this week is sent in by a listener named James Truitt. A couple of times a year, I allow myself to just do something crazy with Who's That Noisy. I love this noisy, and it's crazy. Prepare yourself.
All
right.
trouble.
All right, so what the hell is that? So you guys have a rough week trying to figure out that one.
It's painful.
I absolutely love this, and you're going to love what it is. I know a lot of people out there will probably know it. Send in the emails. Take your best guess. I want Steve to know this. Steve?
Yeah.
I like funny sounds, okay?
I hear you.
That's my baseline. All-time favorite, one of my absolute favorite noises is what? What's your favorite, Ev?
Oh, it's the, what do you call it? La, la, la.
La.
La, 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 la. La. I don't even know what to call it. It's the la la.
That one has definitely the most, I think it is called the la la talk. That one has the most staying power.
Well, you also
throw back to that one.
We love the, who said Lisa? Remember that? Lisa.
But he wasn't actually saying Lisa. Was
no,
he?
No. We morphed it into Lisa because that's one of our sponsors.
So Jay, whoops. Jay, I also love the sci-fi like blaster, phaser, laser weapon sounds you did that time. You did like 4 weeks in a row or 3 weeks. Remember?
Yes. Yeah. I did several weeks. That. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Unfortunately, you can only pull that trigger once. You know, Bob?
Yeah.
La, la, la.
All right, so guys, if you think you know what this week's noisies is,
la la, la, la
or if you just want to say hi or send me in a great noisy that you heard, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Jay. We're just going to do some corrections from our live show really quick. One email we got from James from California, and James wrote, "The Soviet space program sent robots to the moon, collected rocks from the moon, brought them back to Earth before anybody walked there." He's quoting Bill Nye from our live show. And he says, "This is incorrect. Apollo 11 made the first successful sample return from another solar system body. Two Soviet missions were planned to do it before Apollo 11, but they both failed." Who is correct, Bill or James? James is right. So
yeah,
I double triple checked it. So yeah, so the Luna 16 or Lunik 16 was the first Soviet unmanned space mission to return samples from the moon. This was after Apollo 11 and 12, and after multiple failed missions. So the Apollo missions did do it first, but the Soviet Union was able to return samples from the moon with robots, which is the point that Bill was making. They did it without people. They did it just with robots. But the Apollo did it first. But the other thing is worth mentioning that the lunar landers returned very little. The Lunik 16 was 101 grams. Then there was the Luna 20, 30 grams. Luna 24, 170 grams. Compared to the Apollo mission, which returned hundreds of kilograms.
Yeah.
Hundreds of kilograms or hundreds of pounds. Yeah. Of rocks from the surface of the moon. Yeah, big difference. But yes, Bill's point is well taken. You know, robots can still do stuff even on their own. But to be correct, the point, Apollo did do it first. Also, Evan, you had a lot of feedback on your piece. Mm. You were talking about the girl Alyssa who has availed herself of all of the Apollo, all the NASA training programs and all of the visitor centers, et cetera.
Yeah.
But what was the feedback you got on that?
Well, that technically she's not being trained by NASA, that she's not officially part of NASA in really any capacity other than the fact that she's taken advantage of being able to do all these things that are available to the public, especially young kids, like participating in these particular space camp programs and visiting all the centers that they have around the country. I did mention in the show though that she would be eligible at age 18 to apply to become go under the official training of NASA. So there was some correction needed there, clarification.
Yeah, clarification, I think. But I do think it does bring up a point, and we try to be good about this, but it's hard, with unscripted discussions, especially live shows. It's always the pressure is very high. But it's important when reporting science news, I think, even something fluffy like this, to clarify what you're not saying, right? And to also clarify how things have been misreported. So even if the details we're giving are technically correct, we don't want to create the wrong impression. We have to keep an eye towards anticipating and sort of pre-correcting any misconceptions. Like, to be clear, I'm not saying that she is an official NASA astronaut or trainee. She's just doing this all on her own, and she hopes to apply next year when she's eligible at age 18. Whatever.
Nothing wrong with a little extra clarity. Nothing wrong at all.
I know, but we could get in an endless loop of clarifying what we're saying. It really, you know, sometimes you could literally be endlessly clarifying. And we have to cut it off somewhere, but we do try to be aware of that. We do try to do that. We will make corrections when it seems like it's necessary, but, that is just a good little tidbit. It's just a tip on how to report science news correctly. It's as important to say what you're not saying as what you are saying.
Didn't we also get an email from somebody saying that she is from like a really small town in the South?
The one positive email we got was that she's from Louisiana. And it was from somebody who's from Louisiana. And they're like, don't fail to mention that she comes from my home state of Louisiana.
Yeah, and that like, and that she's not from like a super big city. So this is somebody who's kind of maybe has less means, or for whatever reason, she's not as connected. And so that's like a big accomplishment.
And there's some local pride going on there, which is fine.
Mm-hmm, yeah, for sure.
Definitely.
We have a good interview coming up with an Australian skeptic. So let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Alethea Dean. Alethea, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
And you're joining us tonight because you are one of the co-conveners of Skepticon 2018, a skeptical conference held in Sydney, Australia. So how is that going?
It's quite exciting so far. We have almost finalized our lineup of speakers, and it's going to be a really fantastic mix. We're really excited, as I think you guys know from having all of you having been to Sydney, Australia for our various conventions in the past. It's a great city to have it.
It's a wonderful really city,
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I went to Skepticon last year, right?
Yeah, that's right. You were one of our headline speakers and charmed all the guests, including my husband.
Uh-oh. Those American accents, right, Kara?
That was so fun. Skepticon was so fun. I have to say, there is something really warm about the Australian skeptic community. Not that our American compatriots.
I was going to say, yeah, because we're all assholes.
Well, we're not all assholes. But there is a really cool vibe in Sydney.
Like, totally.
It's so welcoming, and it's just so fun.
All right, here's my one complaint, Alethea, and you need to take care of this. You need to personally handle this before we ever return to Sydney.
Yes, I know what you're going to say. Say it.
I want the bats back.
Yeah, what happened to the bats?
Bring
the
back the bats.
Oh, like
the
actual
foxes?
Yes.
The flying foxes, yes.
Oh, okay. I will personally see to that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So what happened? You guys got rid of them in Sydney, right? You had to get rid of them because they were a hazard, I guess, right?
Because they were a tourist attraction?
I don't think they were ever a tourist attraction, but I don't think Visit New South Wales ever featured them. But you know, they love the fig trees around the native fig trees, and at night sunset you'd often see them rising from the parks. But
it's amazing.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It's not been as dramatic in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's sad. You can still see them at the wildlife reserve places, though.
Yeah, for some reason they don't get as much press as the wallabies and the kangaroos and the cute things.
It was amazing. They would fill the skies every night. It was so amazing.
And they're huge.
Oh, yeah. They have a 6-foot wingspan for sure. Whoa. We have tiny bats over here.
Yeah, that's true. Do you know what my favorite Australian animal is?
What is your favorite?
Kangaroo.
Oh, it's the quokka.
Smiley
one.
They're so cute.
What's a quokka?
They look, they're like a cross between, I don't know, a squirrel and a panda. I don't know. They look like they're smiling all the time. They're adorable.
Oh, they're so cute.
They
you guys
adorable.
Look them up.
They look exactly like the, what was the animal on Caddyshack?
The gopher.
Gopher. It looks like the gopher from Caddyshack for real.
But it's like a marsupial gopher. It's almost like
family.
A mini wallaby, right? It's like wallaby-esque, but little and cute.
But little and cute. And smiley.
Yeah. And smiley. Do you have any like musical guests or magicians or any sort of fun programs going on this year at Skepticon?
So we don't have a musical act this year, but we do have the return of Vyom Sharma, who is a medical doctor who also happens to be a practicing magician. Cool. So he was one of our speakers from last year. It was amazing. And we're going to have him back on a panel this year.
He can make your pancreas disappear?
Yeah, but we've got him on a medical panel that's headed up by one of our committee members, Dr. Brad McKay, who is on Embarrassing Bodies Down Under. It's a show that talks about medical problems people are too embarrassed to go to their doctors about, but they're happy to get their dinglings out on TV.
Yeah, funny that.
I love Brad.
Yeah, he's great.
He was I definitely met him like a few times when I was down there. Now we follow each other on Twitter. He's always tweeting really great stuff.
Yeah, he's hilarious. And yeah, it was his idea to do a medical panel called Someone is Wrong on the Internet. Awesome. It's going to give all our medical experts a lot to talk about and a lot to get angry over.
I love it.
What about Dr. Carl? Is he going to be there this year?
Dr. Carl's going to be opening for us.
Awesome. He's great.
Yep.
He's great. He's been one of our SETIA supporters over the year and is always bringing a lot of quirky energy to the table. So we're really looking forward to having him open things up for us.
Alethea, has he ever signed a book over to you?
Not yet. I know he's got a ton of books, though, so I really don't have an excuse for not having one of his books on my shelf yet.
You should ask him, because I'm trying to figure out if I'm super special or if he signs all his books the same. Because when I met him when I was at Skepticon, he signed one of his books over to Kara, his best friend in the whole wide world. Wow. And I had known him for about 5 minutes. Well, I want to see if he signs yours the same way.
I won't tell this story, and I'll just get him to sign a book, see how that goes. Okay. Will you be hurt if I get to be his BFF?
No, I won't be hurt. It'll actually probably be a little bit less creepy. No, I shouldn't say creepy, but a little more normal. But I will say I was like beaming after he wrote that inscription for me.
See, not creepy, just a lot of pressure.
Seriously. All right.
I have a book signed here by Dr. Carl.
What does it say?
It says, "To my new best friend forever."
Dang it. Yes. That's his go-to.
So, we exchanged books because we're going to have him on the show soon. He's like traveling. As soon as he gets back, we're going to bring him on the show because he has a book coming out called Carl, the Universe, and Everything.
I like it.
Yep. Yeah, he's prolific, and so
he has so many books.
We're so delighted that he's put aside the time for us.
Yeah. He also has really cool shirts.
He has the best shirts in showbiz.
And
you can always tell
when
you're at a science event and there's a tall, bald man with a very cool shirt on.
Yep.
That's Dr. Carl.
Very cool.
So tell us more about who's coming to the conference.
We've got, I think, quite a good mix of international and local speakers. We've got Cybabe coming over from the States.
We love her.
Yeah. And I guess a regular on your podcast, Pamela Gay, is coming as well. She's going to be speaking with Professor Alan Duffy, who's an astronomer from Australia, and talking about reaching for the stars. Also, an international traveler, we've got Carrie Poppy, who does the Ono Ross and Carrie podcast. Sure. Love her.
I love that show.
Hilarious. Yep. Yeah. I think good inspiration for skeptics who want to kind of see what the other side's all about.
Oh, yeah.
And also another podcaster, we've got Dr. Alice Howarth from Skeptics with a K, who's coming over from the UK. So one of the Merseyside skeptics. And yeah, she's skipping out on QED to be at our conference. So it means ours is better, right?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Oh. Sure.
We've also got another panel. So I spoke, I think, briefly about our medical panel. And we've also got one that's talking about, I guess, the more classic subjects of skepticism. Ghosties, cryptids, and yaoi's, oh my. We've got a paranormal investigator on it. We've got documentary maker who's followed yaoi hunters through the bush. And we've got Susan Blackmore, who's going to be talking about out-of-body experiences.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, she is such a great
awesome,
speaker.
Yeah,
and also Lynn Kelly, who's an expert on psychics and their cold reading techniques.
When it comes to kind of the topics, the skeptic topics that we usually cover here in the States, you know, we talk a lot about pseudoscience and medicine. And we do still talk about things like psychics and mystics and Bigfoot and these issues because they still crop up from time to time. Are these big industries in Australia?
I would say they're getting increasingly niche. Okay. I think when the Australian Skeptics first started operating, the idea of, you know, like the UFOs and dowsing, those were hot items, both in, you know, people actually practiced these things and thought about these things. I would say more and more the woo has moved more into alternative medicine and things like that, mm-hmm. with the extraordinary flat earth thing becoming popular for some reason. Yeah. But but the classic stuff is still there and there's still people who are passionately into it. And I think that's it's a fascinating mindset. And it's also, I think, a great return to why a lot of people got into skepticism in the first place.
Alethea, is this the first conference you have run?
It is. I was volunteered for it by Aaron Segev, president of the Australian Skeptics. And it's been a big challenge so far, but also
it's a lot of work, right?
Quite exciting. Oh my god, yes. I think what the reason he asked me and my fellow convener to take the reins this year was he was worried that with him doing it would be a lot of you know, stuff he liked and stuff that had been going on before, and he wanted to get some fresh eyes on it. And I think something that we've really tried to do is try and get it a little less male.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, girl.
Yeah, I think the unfortunate thing with a lot of conventions so far, not purposely, but they tend to be very male centric and very white. So I don't know. I guess a little bit of affirmative action and trying to see what interesting women speakers that might be available for this. And I think for the first time ever, we've been able to get a few more women than men on the panel, which has actually already got a complaint from someone who's refusing to come because of the gender disparity.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, they complained when there was more men than women on the panel, right?
Yeah.
What? Really? Wow.
Well, that's funny because we did the exact same thing as we tapped a friend of ours, actually Bob's girlfriend, Liz, to be on the committee and to be the head of our speaker committee. And it's like, yeah, go ahead. You know, let's really increase the diversity of Nexus. And it worked and it came off great. It was a really great conference. Mm-hmm. It gets a lot of fresh blood and new topics and everything into the skeptical conference. So I think it is a good idea. And it's not just affirmative action. It's just, you know, it is all about fresh blood and just not, you know, having the same people giving the same talks over and over again, you know?
Yeah, because unfortunately, the way it feeds into itself is you want to have high profile speakers, but the ones that have a high profile are people that have spoken before that tend to be men. So, yeah, you have to kind of like force it a bit to get women a platform. But, you know, these are fantastic speakers with really interesting backgrounds and a lot to say. So I think it's going to be a fantastic conference. I'm really excited to hear what Sue Knight has to say. She's built one of the philosophy for young people programs in the country. So rather than going into class and listen to religious chaplains talk about how you need God to be moral, she's built in a fantastic ethical program for that's built around secular ethics. And, you know, we're going to have also Kirsten Banks, who's a young astronomer who's interested in Aboriginal astronomy. So these are people who haven't had a huge platform within our community before, but I think they're going to be very exciting.
Yeah, it sounds great. So, Alethea, give us the dates and how people can get tickets and what's going on.
It's going to take place in October this year on Saturday the 13th and Sunday the 14th. And tickets are available from the Australian Skeptics website. And for more information about the conference, people can go to convention.skeptics.com.au and you can see our list of speakers, the convention venue in Chatswood. If they have any questions, email us. We also have a phone number there. You can bother our our executive officer about it.
So good luck with everything, Alethea. It sounds like it's going to be a great conference.
Thank you so much, Steve. And thank you for letting us talk about it on your show.
Sure, no
I
problem.
I want to go. Let's just
or,
go.
No worries, I should say.
Send us coffee.
No worries.
No worries, mate.
We want the Australian coffee in the United States.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Flat white, please.
Oh, yes. I remember that.
Thank you guys so much.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have three interesting news items this week. No theme, you'll be happy to know. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy. I do have to point out that I swept you during the live show with facts that I took from our book.
That was so brutal. Yeah.
That sucked.
All right.
Low point.
Shows you how much meat there is, how deep, how specific that is. Okay, here we go.
Superficial we are.
Item number one. Astronomers find the rust-colored dust that covers Mars originates from one large geological structure at the equator. Item number two. A new study finds that eradication of malaria-carrying mosquitoes in endemic regions could cause significant disruption to the local ecosystem. And item number three. Engineers have created a transistor based on excitons rather than electrons, opening the door to a new technology of excitronics. Evan, go first.
The rust-colored dust that covers Mars originates from one large geological structure at the equator. Yeah, it's called the Rust Belt. It's made of metal, and it gets all over the place. this is amazing. Really? Totally new information to me. Never heard of anything like this before. I don't even know what to do with it. Boy, that's a large structure indeed to cover an entire planet with the stuff. But it's been around for a long time, so it's only really a factor of time more than size. Maybe. The next one. The new study finds that eradication of malaria-carrying mosquitoes in endemic regions could cause significant disruption to the local ecosystem. Well, that doesn't sound crazy. They carry malaria, but they must do other things as well, like, I don't know, pollination and some other things. So if you're going to get rid of the mosquitoes, you're getting rid of other things along with it. That kind of makes sense. The last one, oh boy, a transistor based on excitons?
Excitons.
Jeez. Rather than electrons. What the hell is an exciton? Opening the door to a new technology of excitronics. All right. That one has to be science because that is just beyond out there. Crazy. Oh my gosh, I don't even know what to make of that one. That's got to be science because I have no idea what's going on there. All right, mosquitoes or Mars? Got to put my chip down on one of these two. They're kind of equal in my head. I'm going to say the mosquitoes one because I really want this one to be the fiction because, damn it, let's get rid of these malaria-carrying mosquitoes once and for all. Breed them out. Thank you.
Okay, Kara.
Done.
I thought that it was the mosquito one from the time you read them, mostly because my knowledge about Mars and excitons is limited to nil. But from what I understand about mosquitoes, they obviously do have some pollination and some ecological purposes, but there's also so many species of mosquitoes in existence, and only a fraction of them actually carry malaria. So I do think that if we use some sort of gene drive to eradicate simply the malaria-carrying mosquitoes, we would still have enough species available within most regions, endemic species available within most regions, to carry out the ecological purposes that they do. So I could be wrong about that. It may be that there are places where there are fewer species available than I think. But from what I've gathered, from what I understand, at least about my studies of malaria and talking to people about the eradication efforts, I think it's probably okay to eradicate them using gene drives. There may be some unintended consequences, but I think that aspect through the modeling is probably okay. So I'm going to say that that's the fiction.
Jay?
The one about the rust coming from a single place on Mars, I mean, I could see that. It has to be coming from somewhere. You know, the regolith is definitely, I guess it's iron. It has a lot of iron in it. I mean,
is
you
it
would
called
think
regolith on Mars?
Yeah. Why not?
I think so. Yeah, it's still regolith on Mars.
Specific.
Yeah.
All right.
No, it's not moon specific. It's not moon specific.
No. You know, the question here is it coming from one place or is it coming from like, you know, hundreds or thousands of places? So, okay. I could see that maybe there's one huge area and it, you know, the dust storms would spread that stuff around pretty easy if it was coming from one place. So I could see that. Yeah. And piggybacking on what Kara was saying about the mosquitoes, I agree. And I also think, Kara, that, you know, if they got rid of this one strain or even, you know, a whole bunch of strains that could transmit malaria, that the other ones would very quickly fill that hole, right? Because mosquitoes, their population can explode depending on how much surface water there is and all that stuff. So I would imagine that if they did kill out a bunch, that there would be a whole second, you know, whole new wave or batch of others that are just filling whatever gap that they leave. So I could see that one as being the fiction. And then this last one, they created a transistor that's based on excitons rather than electrons. Yeah, I mean, this one to me, now I know Steve, and I know Steve likes words that he's like, you know, would they know what that word means and all that? And because I can't really argue it, but I can argue the second one, I'm going to say the second one, the mosquitoes is the fiction.
And Bob?
Yeah, from Mars, it seems odd, but I could definitely see that, especially with the global winds that could distribute this kind of stuff throughout the entire planet. So there's the mechanisms there. I'm not familiar with any such a singular geological structure that could do that, but I'm a little skeptical of this, but I think it's feasible for sure. The malaria one, yeah, if you wiped out all the mosquitoes, which is kind of where this news item, you know, what Steve wants us to think, then yeah, that would probably clearly be really bad. But then again, I'm not sure exactly what the role the mosquitoes play in the ecosystem. I could see the damage being less than you would think, but I don't know. I think the bats would be kind of pissed off. Let me go to three here. The excitons. Yeah, I've heard of them. It's basically just like a mobile unit of energy, kind of like an electron in a way. So I could see that you could base some sort of electronics on excitons, and that's really fascinating. But I didn't read anything about this. But I mean, excitons aren't fake for sure. But basing a new industry on that would be interesting. So that's kind of feasible as well. Yeah. So Kara makes a lot of sense here with the mosquitoes. Yeah, it makes sense that it would be a small fraction. And if the way we could target things now, I think that makes the most sense. So this one seems like fiction as well.
So you guys are all in agreement. So let's take these in order. Astronomers find the rust-colored dust that covers Mars originates from one large geological structure at the equator. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Oh, boy, man.
Oh, wow. Damn. That's cool.
It's crazy. Really interesting.
Is this a new one?
Yeah.
New discovery?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so the structure, Medusae Fossae,
ooh, I like,
is about 1,000 kilometers across, so it's big, but it's big at the equator. And they think that this eroding away is basically spreading its rust-colored dust all around the planet. And that Mars is red because of this one structure. This is based upon analyzed data collected from Spirit and Opportunity, two of the rovers, showing that there's a chemical match, basically. This is not originating from different sources or all over Mars, that probably they all have a very common source. And that matches. Yeah.
Common signature? I mean, couldn't there be a similar structure on the other side of the planet that's just been eroded away and you can't really see evidence of it anymore? Wouldn't that have the same chemical signature? I mean, it's iron. You know?
It's not, no, because it's also sulfur and chlorine. There's multiple things. Obviously, it's got to be the ratios have to exactly match.
So it's kind of be like a fingerprint then, aren't it?
Yes, yes.
That makes
exactly.
More sense.
Yeah, it's a chemical signature. It's not just like, oh, well, it's rust. You know, no, obviously, there's multiple things and enough that you can identify that it's probably all coming from the same source.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I mean, wasn't Mars completely and entirely enshrouded like a couple weeks ago?
Yeah, there are dust storms.
It's horrible. Yeah.
The entire damn world.
Yeah, the entire planet's covered in a single dust storm. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Didn't we lose power to a rover in that?
Dusty.
Yeah, usually because it blocks out the sun.
Yeah. But, like, didn't one go offline? We're not going to be able to get it back?
Yeah, I'm sure that
I think there was
all of them eventually.
Concern about that, yeah.
Oh, because of the dust storm specifically?
So, reading the original article, it says that insight to investigations from past and current rovers have revealed the dust to be consistently and markedly enriched with both sulfur and chlorine relative to the average Martian soil. So in other words, it has a different chemical signature than the soil all around Mars, indicating that it has a single source. It goes into a lot more technical detail. I'm just giving you one highlight.
That's cool.
All right, let's go on to number two. A new study finds that eradication of malaria-carrying mosquitoes in endemic regions could cause significant disruption to the local ecosystem. You guys all think this one is the fiction, and this one is the fiction. Good job, guys.
Yes, we reversed our sweep.
You did. Did any of you read this?
Nope.
No. Nope.
No, but I did interview somebody on my podcast recently who specializes in mosquito net technology. And we talked a lot. She's an entomologist, so we talked a lot about mosquitoes.
There's a lot of different species of mosquito, obviously. This study was based not on the pollinating activity of mosquitoes, and many people might be surprised to find that mosquitoes can be pollinators. I don't necessarily think they all are pollinators. There are some species of mosquitoes which are. And mosquitoes are also opportunistic. Like, yeah, they'll, even if they prefer a blood meal, if they're having a dry spell, they will eat sucrose. You know, they will go after other sources. Or like only the breeding females eat blood. And then at other times they may pollinate, whatever. But I couldn't find specifically if, Anopheles gambiae, which is the species that spreads malaria, if they pollinate. I don't think so. But this study was based upon them as food. The notion being, the concern was, if we wipe them out, is anyone else going to go extinct because we're taking away their food supply? Yeah. And what they found was that there is essentially no species that they could find that relies heavily, let alone entirely, on this one species, on Anopheles.
Oh, that's good.
And that they have plenty of alternate mosquito food sources or larval-based food sources that it would basically not have any significant impact on the ecosystem. Also, these mosquitoes—
Off with their heads.
Yeah, they're good at hiding, you know, that they breed in small temporary pools most of the time, not all the time, and they come out a lot at night, and, you know, they're just very good at not being eaten, so that they're not an important food source in the ecosystem. So they basically concluded, yep, we could wipe them out and not have to worry about any significant ecological effect, which is good.
Awesome. Good, very good.
We should eradicate them. All right. All this means that engineers have created a transistor based on excitons rather than electrons, opening the door to a new technology of excitronics. Bob, did you hear about this one?
Did not hear about it.
Do you know about excitons and excitronics?
I know what excitons are, but I haven't heard much about excitronics. So
let me give you my understanding of what an exciton is, and you could tell me if this was your understanding. So, because obviously we're trying to just approximate physicists who actually know what these things are. So an exciton is a quasi-particle. It's not an actual particle. Quasi. It's a particle-like quasi-particle.
Like a phonon is similar.
Yeah, so it's created when an electron absorbs a photon, and then the electron gets bumped into a higher energy state, and the hole, the metaphorical hole that it leaves behind in its previous energy state, is this quasi-particle that it combines with the electron, and the two things together, like the electron and the hole it leaves behind, is the exciton. So you could kind of think of it like an excited electron, but they talk about it as being this combination of the electron and the hole that it left behind, at least in the article that I'm reading. That's the metaphor they're using.
So it's the combination, really.
It's the combination. And then when the electron gives off the photon, it falls back into its hole, its lower energy state. And then the exciton goes away. It ceases to exist. So, but I guess you could, in more simplistic terms, you could think of it as an excited electron. But it is this sort of transient quasi-particle, and they were able, essentially, to create a transistor where excitons are the energy carrier, the information carrier. And so they're saying this creates
the— How do they maintain that state?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. They were able to normally— so we've known about these for a while, but they only exist at very low temperatures and very transiently, and they were able to find materials that will allow it to exist at room temperature for a long time. And so that was the breakthrough.
So what's the benefit of an exciton over just an electron?
Basically, they said you could make electronics that use a lot less energy and are a lot faster.
Okay, that sounds good to me.
Yeah, it sounds good. I mean, this is all obviously theoretical, but they made a transistor, apparently. So they used 2D materials. They used tungsten diselenide and molybdenum disulfide.
Ooh, molybdenum.
Yeah, molybdenum. Libdenum. Right. So they said the excitons in these materials exhibit a particularly strong electrostatic bond, and even more importantly, they are not quickly destroyed at room temperature.
Is that name really going to catch on?
Who the hell knows?
It'll catch on like in academic circles, but if it actually does become involved in our regular technology, we're just going to call them electronics still.
Well, I don't know. I admit that excitronics does not roll off the tongue.
It's no. Really and electronics... I bet you if you went out on the street, Jimmy Kimmel style, and surveyed 100 people and asked them about the electron, like if you figured out a way to ask them where you were trying to ask for the answer electron when you were talking about electron, they wouldn't know that those two things are related.
Yeah. Probably only like 5-10% of the population.
Yeah. So I don't think it'll catch on, but it is still cool. Excitronics.
Yeah. They'll come up with some marketable, cooler name for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
We all want so badly to believe in miracles. That's what makes us so vulnerable. And that's what makes the self-help movement so rich. And that was written by Steve Salerno, who's the author of the book Sham, How the Self-Help Movement Made America Helpless.
Who we've had on the show.
And we've had him on the show, I think, a couple of times. And he's quite an expert in this particular field. Did a lot of research in it.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, you got it, brother.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.